Welcome to Cannon Fodder, a behind-the-scenes look at the Glass Cannon Podcast.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Cannon Fodder. My name is Joe O'Brien.
And I am, let's see here.
Oh, we're doing it again.
Clio Award winner Troy LaVey.
What is a Clio Award?
I think they're like awards for advertising, like best ad, best truck ad.
Ah.
The Clio Awards. And I'm surprised that people know that about me, but I am a Clio Award winner.
You're using the random table of Troy nicknames that was submitted by
Brent Wachholder.
By Brent. Thank you, Brent.
Thanks again, Brent. It's been a couple weeks since we used it. It was a lot of momentous cannon fodders, but I want to bring it back.
Yes, we are here recapping and looking behind the scenes of episode 101 of the Glass Cannon Podcast, an episode where I think the weight of the world was on you, Troy, to repeat the epicness of a four-hour episode 100. How did you feel about how it turned out?
I was pretty happy with it. I mean, I thought the onus was very much on especially you, Matthew, and Grant, especially.
You're talking about the reunion.
Yeah, the reunion was the thing that I was most interested in that I really couldn't do much with. I had to just set up the tone and let you guys figure that out. So once we got through that, I kind of figured that it was going to lead to the dragon fight. I knew that that was potentially on deck, but I had to be prepared for a number of different things because I didn't talk to you guys and I didn't know where you were going to take it. The only thing I knew was that I was going to take the storylines and converge them, have those timelines finally meet up.
Yeah, so we go through this long prequel in episode 100, introduced to some new characters, and then see that all come to fruition in episode 101. I mean, the climax of the story of those three new characters really did happen in 100, but now we see the fallout. We see the epilogue of that story, especially for a character like Pembroke, where right. We think that he was probably one of the guys in the cell, and in fact that is confirmed. He's one of the old men in the cells, and he's able to talk and interact with Della, which I thought was very interesting. Have you ever, in your gaming experience, had players that were regularly playing two characters in the same session?
No,
in the same
game? With the exception of what we're doing with Umlo, actually, yeah, in your Wrath of the Righteous campaign, I was playing two characters. I forgot all about
that. That is the correct answer. I wanted to see if you remembered that.
Yeah, I was playing because we needed someone to be the cleric, and we kind of mixed up who our players were. We went through a change from we started out with one group, and then there was some scheduling conflict, so you brought in some new people, got rid of some other people, and we ended up just playing with myself, Skid, and our friend Ari.
So it was only three players.
It was only three, and so I said, well, I'll have a fourth character come in, and they'll be the cleric. So I played that cleric in addition to my Inquisitor. And it is a ton of work, even at low levels, if you're not dealing with like just straight up hack and slash fighters.
Was this a concern for you coming into episode 101? Were you like, am I going to have Joe talking to himself and Skid talking to himself? Not that you could imagine a lot of Nestor and Pembroke interplay, but were you concerned about that at all as a GM, allowing the players this much freedom, really, with the story?
No, I mean, because I trust you guys to do that. I know when I have to do that, when I'm like having two NPCs talk to each other in front of you guys, it gets a little confusing because I'm trying, you know, I don't want to go on too long and, oh, it's the Troy Show playing all these NPCs talking
to each other.
But I wanted that to happen. I wanted to have Sir Will talk to Lork and whatnot. And here's a little funny behind the scenes tidbit. At the end of 99, when I have Della or when Della and Baron come in and see an old man face down in a cage, see two other people and see Lork, the reason I purposely didn't describe the other cages is because I did not know how episode 100, these characters that were going to come in, were going to turn out. So I wanted to be open to say, okay, well, Pembroke's in a cage, Orphis is in a cage, Phariza's in a cage. In this case, Orphis dead, Phariza Firaza escaped, and Pembroke was the only one. And then, of course, Razmataz, too. So I left it purposely blank because I didn't know how it was going to turn out.
That's a perfect idea. It was the perfect setting to have that sort of play out, because if you have a dark room filled with cages and that's where you end the cliffhanger, then there is this element of being able to slot in later who's actually in there, which I just think was a great idea. But we see the passage of time that happened because Razmataz is no longer charmed. And we hear from Pembroke that he can't, that he doesn't have his spell book.
Yeah.
And thinking about that, in turn, I mean, the first thing you think about with Lork is that he doesn't have feet, so that's why he's completely ineffective. The second thing that I didn't really think about, because I wrote him off with his feet, is all his gear is gone.
Yeah.
All those magic items, Gorham's Thorn, where is that stuff? Where is the spell book? These are questions that are hugely important to this party, because I imagine right now that you imagine Skid could very well be playing Pembroke and Nestor at the same time, mm-hmm. possibly in combat. He needs that spell book in order to be an effective character. And making, is it your idea, and I don't want to project too much of the story, but was your idea like, I'll take away the spell book so that he can't really be a legitimate competitive combat character in the story? Was that part of the thinking behind it?
Yes and no. I mean, all I will say is that these characters are now characters in the story. They are not relegated to the role of NPC. They are characters, and they're going to fulfill certain roles. And at a certain point, they may end up being the mains. You know what I mean? So seeing how it all unfolds, I don't know. That's up to the dice. That's up to the story. But they are certainly mechanically nerfed right now. I mean, say Lork has feet, but he has no armor and doesn't have Gorham's Thorn. Pembroke doesn't have the spellbook. But do those still exist in the world? Well, we're going to have to find out.
That we will have to find that out.
Yeah.
Lork, for example, do you think that he is a PC as opposed to an NPC? Because we have gotten mail from people that have said, oh, how does Joe feel about you now making Lork an NPC? Since he can't really be a PC with no feet, he's not going to be involved in combat or anything like that. I sort of felt like with 101 that you were looking to me to control Lork or say what Lork was going to do about everything. Are you considering these characters PCs fully and not NPCs at all?
1,000%.
So Lork is completely under my control right
Lork
now.
Lork is completely under your control. He lost control. You lost control of him when you gave him up.
Sure.
But he is yours again, and you can be like, oh, great, I have a guy that doesn't have feet.
That's but I fine mean, with me.
You know, he's... I would say he's in a similar position to Galabras in a way. You know what I mean? I think for Galabras to be taken out of that coma, for Lork to regrow feet, you need a very high-level cleric. I think you need like a 12th-level cleric, which is way beyond any of your means. Now, was Taram Shinnaman 12th level? Guess we'll never know.
Yeah.
But, for all intents and purposes, you guys are 100% PCs in this story. And I think a lot of people were like, oh, that was a really cool one-off. I liked seeing those characters. Well, those characters are still there. They are in this story, and Firaza is out there as well somewhere.
Yeah, I wonder what Matt... So she is not under your control, you're saying.
No.
She is under Matthew's control.
Matthew and I are talking about what's going on with Firaza during all of this.
You sneaky bastard!
This is why you got to listen to Cannonfodder. We give you a little behind the scenes.
It is a behind the scenes look at episode 101. And I think that the reunion is one aspect of the episode, but then the understanding of course, Nestor to say, what are we going to do here? We can't just carry these people around. These people are completely debilitated. I mean, yeah, we're focusing on Lork and Pembroke right now, but let's not forget Aram and Ymir, who are flayed partially, and so they're in a lot of pain. They're very weak. Yes, we are able to bring them up to enough that they can
move about,
speak, but they can't. They're not in fighting form. So
it's a lot different from when you guys like saved the prisoners that were the ogres. You could just be like, you get back to Shinnerman's Fortune. It's be careful, but there's a lot of you. Just listen for giants and be careful. Go that way. You can't be like, hey guys, find your way out of Minderhell's Valley. Get back to Shinnerman's Fortune. You'll be fine.
We're behind the two walls now.
Yeah,
we're inside of two major walls. Well, and three if you count the tower. So it is a very dicey situation for those PCs. Nestor is like, screw them, which makes total sense. And for the rest of the characters that want to help them, they have to leave him behind when they go upstairs. So it's, let's leave him in the cage. Let's leave it unlocked and act like, you know, we haven't been here and go upstairs. Mm-hmm. Upstairs to where we find a giant hoard of treasure and what else do you expect but a dragon?
Of course.
My question for you as a GM is, listening back to the episode, I can tell that the characters, the players rather, are, and the characters in a way, are fully aware that a dragon is coming. There is no question about it.
Right. And they to you guys' credit, I don't think anybody really said anything. Maybe Matthew might have said something, but for the most part, you guys played it with the, you know, suspending the disbelief.
Well, I mean, not really. We didn't say, oh, here comes a dragon. But what they did do was say, we're looking to the sky. We're constantly keeping our eyes peeled for danger coming down on us. We're looking around. We're looking. So here's my question to you as a GM. It's happened to me. We see how you handled it in this episode. I don't even know if you really remember exactly how you handled it. But when a PC or a group of PCs is on to you for one reason or another, they know exactly where your surprise attack is coming from.
Right.
They're looking right at where your surprise attack is coming from. And the whole point of the encounter is that it's supposed to be a really cool surprise attack. What do you do as a GM when you know the players are already on to you?
I wait until they're in the worst possible place they can be and then have it show up.
So you just keep delaying it until they think maybe they have forgotten about it?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to open with a breath weapon, and I know that it can only go off once every 1d4 rounds, so I wanted to catch as many people in the first breath attack as possible, and this is exactly what's going through my head.
So you waited until Skid specifically said, and then Umlo runs up, and you're like,
oh, actually, I forgot all about Umlo, and I was like, oh, great, I'll get Umlo in there, too.
Now I got him.
Yeah, I mean, that worked out well. Now, to be honest, had it dragged out any longer and it was just one person up there by the treasure, I would have like said, all right, we'll start going through the treasure. You find this and you find this. And does anybody else go up there? Sir Will goes up there too. And then you find this. Anybody else? Oh, Dolly, you want to go? Just that. You know, I was just waiting to get at least three people in that blast.
So what about mechanically speaking? It seemed like you gave them an additional perception check, because they said they wanted to do a perception check for any danger.
Right.
And you gave them a roll and said, you don't see anything.
Yeah.
Then when it was imminent, you said, anyone who's out there, Sir Will being the only one who wasn't, he stayed back by the steps. You said, roll another perception check. And actually, I believe you had Della roll over a perception check and you said, you don't see anything.
Yeah.
So I believe that you were kind of saying in that first perception when they were looking for danger, no matter what, they weren't going to see it. Mm-hmm. Where did this dragon come from exactly that in the open day they would not have seen it coming for a while?
It is perched above the spire on top of an anvil that is on the top of the spire. I think I mentioned that in 100 when the dragon comes flying and you see the top of the spire with the name. So it's perched up there waiting. That initial perception check, there is no danger. But I wanted to give the PCs the benefit of the
because
surprise round perception
check. Because they said they were looking
check.
For it, yeah.
I said, okay, roll your perception. You don't see anything. But then it's coming in.
It's more so,
I rolled stealth for the flight in. And so now I allowed them the requisite
perception check. So it's more check. So that they heard it, really.
Right.
Coming,
now,
you hear the wing beats. Right. Okay, and you know what? I didn't really understand it then. I really, until this cannon fodder, do I understand better that it wasn't open air. Like, I thought that the whole top of this tower was kind of like broken down.
Part
and
of
we
it.
Can see through the ceiling.
Part of it you can, yeah, but it's
part of the ceiling you can see through.
Yeah, this is an enormous, I think it's 160-foot diameter room.
So a lot of it is still intact.
A lot of it is,
enough
that
there's a spire on top that the dragon was perched on.
Perched on,
that is so cool.
It made me think of, like, original Dark Souls. You know, like, very early on in the game, near the Undead Settlement, I think, you see a dragon.
The Undead Burg.
Undead Burg, you see that dragon.
The red dragon, yeah.
And
it's a red dragon.
Yeah, it just sits there. I mean, what a great thing. This goes back to being a kid playing this game. You just want to be able to fight a dragon. And this was a real dragon. And man, were you guys not prepared to fight a dragon?
Yeah, we had already. And you said it. You said it was our fourth combat on the same day without a rest. And it was our fourth combat. So Sir Will was out of his challenge for the day. Obviously, Della was down several spells. She rolls an unbelievable natural 20. Like, what any, you couldn't have a more well-timed natural 20 that turned the whole tide of the combat. Really just incredible attack from Della with that scimitar. And But by that same token, she's in such incredible danger. She's in the shadow of this large beast that has six attacks.
Bite, claw, claw, tail slap, wing, wing.
Just incredible. What were the bonuses to hit?
Now, I did boost this dragon a tiny bit. I gave it like a mock advanced template because I've been doing that lately.
Have boosted its AC.
I did, but I actually, it wasn't as much as you thought. Like, it's still, none of you would have
hit
it.
Was it six? Because I thought it was you boosted it six points.
I will say that it did have a spell on it that boosted its AC right out of the gate. It cast a spell on itself.
That's the tricky thing about dragons, is they're spellcasters as well.
They are phenomenal creatures.
So incredible.
But that's why it's so great. Just have them once in a while. It really, just pepper them into an adventure. It really broadens things to have a battle with a dragon. And to Matthew and Della's credit, her going toe-to-toe with that was a really bold, bold choice, because if that that's why I said, just let me know when you go down, because I knew she was going down. If that second claw had crit, that's a times two. I mean, 1d8 plus 9, that she is permadead.
Right.
If the second claw had crit, or if the second claw had brought her to like 2 and then the tail hit for 1d8 plus 13,
right,
deadzo. So it was really, really bold. But it just goes to show, I mean, you don't have someone that can stand in the face of these creatures. And people are like, well, Delgin, 64 points of damage. Yeah, because she pulled off an amazing crit. Had that not happened, even though that happened, she was almost permanently dead.
She's a bit of a glass cannon.
Yeah.
And in Sir Will, though, this is my problem, is Sir Will is, in a way, the tank. He's got the highest AC in the party. He's wearing heavy armor. And I was frustrated because it still seemed so irrelevant. And I wonder, mechanically, like, what is the point of trying to build a character with high AC when a creature like this dragon... out of its six attacks, it did miss the two wing attacks. But
right.
Four of the six attacks, it rolled over 30. And my AC was 26 against it. So I was feeling somewhat confident that I would block one or two. And I did block the wings. But the wings were like a 16 and an 18 or something.
Yeah.
So
I rolled really low.
So I just wonder, those higher end... did you roll really well, do you remember? Or are the bonuses so high?
The bonuses are so high.
Yeah, it's just... when it comes to a dragon, it just goes to show you, armor is not going to do much of anything.
You got
to
get away from it. I mean... Yes. You need someone with super high AC to stand there and bang with a dragon. Otherwise, get away, use range spells and range attacks. You just can... I mean, what's cool is in the narrative sense, you guys learned a lot about how to fight a dragon or how not to fight a dragon. But I mean, that breath attack took Nestor, Umlo, and Baron out of it.
Right.
They had
to get away.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they still couldn't hit it. I mean, Nestor, who does crazy damage against every giant you face... multi-shot miss, regular shot miss.
Yeah, the AC was so high.
Yeah.
It was a great dragon fight from an imagery perspective, because you're on top of this broken down tower.
Yeah.
It just fit. It fit really well. It was designed really well.
And had you guys not brought it below 25, the next attack was the breath attack. And I mean, there would have been multiple deaths. And I'm not even saying this just because I can say it now. It's after the fact. It didn't happen. I would have 100% done it, and there would have been multiple deaths. The breath attack alone does, it's a DC 21 reflex save. It does 6d10 fire damage.
Oh,
that is death. I mean, that could, Umlo 100% dead.
Umlo 100% dead.
Maybe Nestor.
And, yeah, he was down.
Baron could have gone unconscious, and then you've got Sir Will there who would just have to run.
Let me go back to Della getting clawed down. You tend to, as a GM, stand by a very strict rule with yourself that you do not continue to attack characters that have gone unconscious. Do you believe and recommend that GMs across the board should, when a character goes unconscious, let him be and move on to the next target in order to keep PCs alive? Because that's what it seems like you're doing. You definitely could. Dragons are intelligent. They're not beasts. I mean, they're beasts, but they're intelligent beasts. It absolutely could have killed Della. And you can also argue that it would know that she was unconscious and bleeding out and maybe going to die anyway and move on. That's fine. I'm not saying you made a wrong decision. Mm. I'm just saying, like, if there's GMs out there that really just keep going until the character is dead, do you applaud that decision, or do you question that decision?
Well, to date, I have not continued to attack someone that's unconscious, and that's just something I've decided to do. I will say a time will definitely come when someone is just going to get coup de grace or something, or is still going to get attacked while unconscious. You got to pick that moment. That moment has to really mean something, but it's going to come. I've never done it. I've never seen it done before into a game. It's a real middle finger to that player in a
sure.
way, but you know, hopefully the player will understand that that's what had to happen in that instance.
So, but you would say, generally speaking, to newer GMs out there, it's safer if you just, when the character goes unconscious, don't continue to attack them, even with an intelligent creature, because you don't want to make vile enemies of your players.
Right, right. You know, but you could also remember, like, if it's a super intelligent creature and knows that the rest of the party is just hiding and waiting, you know, this dragon had an intelligence of 16. That's pretty intelligent. Not an intelligence of 24.
No, but it's extremely intelligent.
So you gotta, I would listen to what the party does. If the party is just gonna be like, let's just wait, we're gonna all hang back here and wait and then surprise it and just run away, then kill that character.
Right. Yeah. And here's an idea. You could use an intelligent dragon, even, especially one that speaks common, to just hover over Della and tell everyone else to get out there, or he's going to kill her.
Like Cormug Dedgut did to Lork in episode 100.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Threaten that.
Yeah, that I think is an interesting thing you can do as a GM, is threaten that death to an unconscious character, because the other characters know that this is, that you can do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're unconscious. There's no deus ex machina that's just going to get take care of that for you. The character's unconscious, lying right in front of you.
When you guys were ready to infiltrate Red Lake Fort and you ran up against the, I think it was a tribe of orcs and one giant leading, that's when Lork ranged way ahead. Do you remember that? My plan for that encounter, before you went ranging off ahead, was to have somebody go unconscious and have them threaten, put your weapons down, surrender, and then take you to the same jail where Umlo is being.
And then fight in the pits.
And then fight the bear
pits.
That's what I originally wanted to do, but you know, I couldn't force that to happen. I just, you guys were able to pull it off. I remember by the time Lork got back, everybody was already dead. but my initial plan was to threaten the coup de grace, and then
Lork's gonna lark.
Yeah, Lork had to lark.
Well, the nothing really happens much at the end of this episode.
Nope.
It's sort of just a routine, like we go through the treasure, just kind of, you know, you beat the dragon, flies away, you get its treasure, you know, and then we'll see what happens next week.
Yeah. It was so awesome because you started talking and I didn't see this coming. And I just interrupted you, and I didn't want to make you mad by interrupting you, but I'm like, here's our cliffhanger.
Yeah, well, let me just say, I haven't mentioned it at all in this cannon fodder because I don't want to talk about it. I want to be left alone with my thoughts.
You're the only one not talking about it, by the way.
I would like to be, I have not talked to anybody about it. I do not want to talk to anybody about it. But I will say, from a behind the scenes perspective, this is not something we discussed in the least.
Nope.
This is not something I planned in the least going into this episode. But when the situation, when I saw Della there behind the wall, separated from everybody else,
right,
I just had this thought and I just went with it and you cut me off.
Yeah.
So that was a real honest-to-God cutoff. I was not expecting that at all. So that's all I'm going
to
say.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot wait to see. I have not talked to you. I know you haven't talked to Matthew. And the only thing I did say to you was, do whatever you want.
You know who else said that?
Who?
Matthew.
Did he really?
He did.
Wow.
He's a bold man. It's time to move it on to a little listener mail, Troy.
Is that a new thing for the next 100 episodes?
May edition.
Ah, good, good. We shall dance around the maypole together.
Buddy, it is listener mail, May edition. And by the way, Troy and I are sitting here with a fresh poured margarita.
How good is this?
Cheers, cheers, buddy. The weather has turned in New York City. It is 80 degrees outside. Beautiful. It is. It's time to celebrate the spring, buddy. So cheers.
Cheers to you.
And here's to Steven in Pittsburgh,
oh,
who wrote in
Pittsburgh
with a question. I'm going to take a sip. Steve, I'm going to take a sip. Then I'm going to answer your question.
This is good. Joe came over today with fresh margaritas in like a to-go sippy cup. Big thing of margaritas.
It was too beautiful out.
And so we mixed that with some beer that I had, Narragansett Del Shandy. So it makes this like beer-garita that is phenomenal. And we were going to record Cannon Fodder on my deck. We're like, it's a beautiful day. Let's go outside and record on the deck. And we set all the equipment up and the wind was just buffeting the mic. And it sounded like there was a train running through the studio.
Yeah. If you guys think that we are operating with like professional professional level equipment, I will tell you. We do not have professional level equipment for recording outside.
No.
That is a completely different level of equipment. I mean, we were listening to it and it just, it was like we were in a wind tunnel. And it didn't even seem that bad.
I wanted us to be like radio DJs doing like an appearance somewhere.
Or like
we're here live at this brewery. How's everybody doing?
Right. Or like sports show guys outside the stadium. Right. You know, before. Anyway.
We're not ready for that.
Let's get to Steven's question. Steven asks, how do you organize your information for a campaign run as a GM? I understand the usual idea of reading ahead in the campaign. Troy, you have talked about this before.
Yeah.
But what do you physically do to prepare yourself session to session or overall for the campaign to make it easier on you to reference NPCs, random loot tables, maps, etc.? I'm about to run my first ever Pathfinder game with a fresh group who has no prior knowledge of the game, and I want to give them the best experience possible by staying ahead. Steven, first of all, a cannon fodder thank you to you for GMing a game for new players.
Bottle cap.
That is the thing that we want people to do the most, and we appreciate your effort. It is hard, it is difficult, and we're going to do what we can to try to help you based on the experiences that we've had. Troy, why don't you talk about some of the things you do to organize your information going into these? We've talked about some of these on Cannon Fodder, but try to keep it overarching, not only session prep.
Yeah, I change my methods all the time, and I'm still changing how I do my GM
still
prep.
Learning.
But the basic things that I always do is I get the PDFs of the Adventure Path books. I like having the PDF on my iPad. And the first thing I do, I read the whole thing. I don't take any notes. Maybe I'll like, oh, what is that? I've never heard of that. I'll look it up really quickly. But for the most part, I'm just trying to understand the overall story and just get through that first read through. And then I read all the supplementary material that comes with each Adventure Path book as well. And then I print it out, and by I print it out, I send it to Joe, and Joe prints it out at his job.
Don't tell anybody that.
No one's going to listen. And then I take that, and I three-hole punch it and put it in a binder. And now I start my second read-through. And during my second read-through, I'm like back in high school, highlighting stuff that I think is very important, circling, taking notes, cross-referencing with, you know, the Ultimate Equipment Guide, with the Bestiaries, with all the supplementary books that come with Pathfinder, just to really flesh it out. So I'm taking notes in the liner margins, taking notes in the paragraph and everything. And now lately, I used to do index cards, an index card for every encounter. You're going to fight three ogres. I will have three index cards, one for each ogre with their hit points, their AC, their fortitude, reflex, and will save. Just so that like when Gormley would cast, you know, something that would make all their saves go down by two, I could take ogre number one and change the saves. Now I do that a lot more over Hero Lab. I actually haven't used an index card in a long time. But what I have taken to doing lately that I've... This I found has made things easiest for me, and the hardest thing when you're GMing is you plan so much stuff and then you get to the session and you're like, I forgot what this room is. What's happening right now? And you just, as much as you plan, you just kind of blank sometimes. So what I do is I'm rewriting the book, basically rewriting the story on a Word doc, on a Google document. And I have every, you know, room or every set piece highlighted, and it automatically creates an outline for you when you do this in Google Docs. If you bold it and underline it and press enter and start doing the description of the scene that you're trying to describe, it makes a head like a little outline automatically for you. So now when you guys are exploring Minderhall's Cathedral, I can just be like, oh, okay, they're in the chapter house. Boom, click on chapter house. It scans down to that. And then I have taken what's in the book and I've rewritten it in my own words, sometimes taking their exact words and then adding in things like, all right, there's going to be an NPC here. Let me write what some of the dialogue bits are going to be. Oh, there's treasure. Let me highlight that in green for treasure so I remember to do that. Oh, there's DC perception checks to find a secret door or to find, like, you know, hear noise in the next room. I'll highlight that in its own color as well. So now when you guys come up to a thing, I just have my laptop ready. You know, my iPad is now just for Hero Lab. My laptop will have all that information that I've retyped out. And then I've also started casting using Google Chromecast, casting images onto my TV while we play. You run into an NPC that looks like this. I just started doing that for episode 100. So I'm still changing how I do things. But you see, the common thread throughout all of this is reading, rereading, taking notes, and writing things out in your own way.
And I would add immersion. A lot of the tactics that you're doing are designed to immerse the players deeper in the story. Things like casting those images help us so much to be more focused on the story. And that is, I think, the heart of Steven's question is, how do I keep my players interested moment to moment? Which is tough. And I really appreciate your question. It's a really good question, specifically because the more prepared you are, and not just in reading the adventure, but logistically prepared in knowing where your information is and how to access it quickly, is going to make a more enjoyable experience for your players. You're putting in that extra work, that extra organization for your players. You do it all for them to make the game smoother and quicker so that in a shorter amount of time, they can get more encounters in or more role play in or whatever the case may be. I will say for my part, from an organizational perspective, I have a GM binder that I ran Wrath of the Righteous for a little while, and when I changed over to the Curse of the Crimson Throne, I got rid of it and replaced a lot of the stuff. But I didn't change the organization where I
can have, I just say, by the way, I'm always jealous of your binders. Your binders, yeah. They're like color coded, yes. Little tabs and stuff. I'm like, man, my binder is shit compared to your binder.
Such a nerd. But I also do like the PDFs because I would while I have the Curse of the Crimson Throne book from Paizo, which is gorgeous, it hurts my heart inside to like mark that up.
I can imagine.
So I also bought the PDF of Curse of the Crimson Throne. So I use the actual book to kick back and just read it. And that is the best way to do it. When I'm actually running a session, I have a binder where I print out the PDF and I do not actually put the whole PDF in the binder. I save some space because I know they're not going to cover the entire thing. So I actually put more of the flavor text in this back part of the adventure path part, which has more information about the adventure. And I only put in the pages that I think we would cover in the next 2 to 3 sessions up front, just to keep it a little thinner, a little more streamlined. Then I separate out NPCs. I have a tab that is just backstories on each NPC, a page on each one, or maybe a paragraph on each one of their background.
And are you retyping that from the book, or you're just pulling
some of
the
them,
actual?
Some of them have the story, and I highlight the keywords, because the keywords are the thing that are going to allow you to immerse the player more easily. When the player begins to role play with that character, if you immediately start by naming the school that they went to or naming the guard group, they were in the Black Arrows or whatever it is,
right.
That is immersion. That's further immersion. It makes the player feel like this character is very real, is very rooted in the world, as opposed to only making the character something like, this guy speaks with a southern accent, period. That is not as immersive. So giving him traits that are named world traits for Galarian, because every game I run is in Galarian, I utilize the NPC tab for that. I have another tab for experience, where I flip to that real quick so I can write in player experience when they get it. I have another tab for calendar, so I can mark really quick. I print out each page is a 30-day calendar, and on each page with little blocks, I just write the briefest of brief summaries, fought Cyclops. That's it. And right. You know that that's the main thing that happened that day, and then on to the next day. And that helps with keeping track of things like fleas and stuff like that.
Right.
That's a big way to keep track of diseases or professions or these things that tick after days, and sometimes you forget them as a GM. The calendar mechanic, for me at least, helps a great deal.
I'm 100% sure I'm going to screw up the Ed and Fleas thing, because you guys are never going to remind me, and I've got so many other things I'm thinking about. I'm like, wait, what day is it? Wait, roll your flea check.
If anything, we'll be distracting.
Joe, I'm 100% sure. I'm predicting this right now. I will screw it up. I know I will.
I also have a treasure tab. You mentioned random loot tables. I will say that at this point, I do not roll with random loot tables anymore because
me neither.
I just have played so much that I generate random loot myself, but I will admit that my random loot is not immersive. My random loot is very practical. It's very, here's how much gold you get, and if I want to drop them a sweet magic item that's relevant to one of their characters, I'll put it in there. Mm-hmm. I don't have plates or a painting of this guy or a blah, blah, which you can get with a random loot generator, that it just makes it feel more like you're in that place wherever you are. So I don't do that, which is a shame. But for me personally as a player, I usually don't care about that flavor. I just want to know what is useful to my party in this loot.
Right.
Everything else I'm just going to sell anyway. And I even said, you know this, in the Curse campaign, I said everything else that I list when you guys find loot in on the spot, we're going to decide if anybody wants to keep it for flavor reasons. And if not, it immediately is going to get transitioned into half its gold value and distributed among the players on the spot.
Yeah, I love that you've decided to do that for Curse, because loot sheets are so exhausting, either in heavy treasure campaigns or even in low treasure campaigns. Just marking down all the emeralds and gems and paintings and statues and sculptures and just sell. Does somebody want this? Does
right.
somebody want this? Does anybody want this +2 greatsword? No? Okay, great. Then we're going to sell it right now and split the gold amongst the party.
Yeah. It helps with Curse because it's set in a city. So yeah. you have that. You don't have to break the fourth wall to say you would be able to sell this within a matter of days. It's irrelevant. We can just do it. It's tougher in Giant Slayer. I believe that, but that is one mechanic I think that makes your job easier, makes the game move a little quicker, makes it a little easier on the players, and even a little more fun on the players because they don't have to worry about all this other stuff.
Right.
But again, that always falls back on your players. What kind of players you have? Do they want to be more enveloped in the fantasy and have to sell everything and carry everything? Do they want to worry about the encumbrance of copper? Mm-hmm. That is a huge thing.
Yeah.
If they do, they might have to leave treasure behind. That makes a difference. The last thing I'll say is I keep a bestiary, a personal bestiary. Where I will print out summaries of the monsters that are coming up that don't have stat blocks in the adventure path. So if it's just a standard monster, I'll print those out. I'll have them in the bestiary. But my first page of the bestiary is all the traits of the different monster types.
So like undead traits and construct traits.
Elemental traits. Exactly. Because yeah. I always forget those. And I think that at the end of the day, that is the main thing you want to focus on as a GM. When you're starting an adventure path or some long campaign, give yourself a long time before you even bring the players in for session zero. Give yourself plenty of time. Don't rush it. Everybody's excited to play. We know that. But take a month. Take 2 months to just read and prepare yourself, because during that time, what you're also going to find out about yourself is the things that you're not good at remembering, the things that you forget. And obviously those things will become more clear to you as you play. But for me, it's traits, monster traits. The difference between, can an undead take a sneak attack?
Yeah.
Take sneak attack damage. Can an undead bleed? I don't think so. I mean, a skeleton can't, right? But what about
a
zombie?
Yeah.
Or yeah, you know, there's a lot of different areas that you can forget about, and this is a simple way to just have on one page next to the first page of one tab in the bestiary all of the monster traits. I recommend that.
You know what I do is instead of printing stuff out, I have all the bestiary PDFs on my iPad, so I'll bring up the monster and I will take a screen grab of it. So look from afar. Don't look too close because I got stuff in here I don't want you to see. I have just a bunch of pages of images of things from various
bestiaries. So it's in your pictures.
Yeah, so I just open up my photos on my iPad and it's, you can't see that. Can't see that one either. No, definitely can't see that one.
We're having
all right, here's a hill giant. You can see that. You know, and so
classic.
Boom, I've got the beautiful image straight out of the bestiary of a hill giant. And so
that's so smart. I've never done that.
You've never done, dude, it'll change your life. It's so much easier, especially when you use your iPad for Hero Lab as well. You just have it right there.
You know what else? It's also a more green decision, because the reason I print the stat block for the generic monster is because I have found in my games that it slows the game down when I have to load it up on the iPad. When
yeah.
I have to, or bring it up on the computer, I have to go on the Wi-Fi, I have to bring up the document, and then find it on the right page. It takes time, and those seconds are precious to the action. And so I print it out.
So I just changed your life.
Yeah, that's a bad, that's bad. If I just take a screen grab, I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
Take a screen grab, save it as an image file on my iPad, and then you can access it so quickly.
And even with Hero
Lab. And then when
you're
done with it, you just delete it.
Right, you just delete it. That's how I know they've done that encounter. I mark the experience points.
And I love that.
But I like it too. Even though I have everything on Hero Lab that describes all the feats with a click of a button and everything, I like having the flavor text. You know, the hill giant, this hunched giant exudes power and a crude, stupid anger. Its filthy fur clothing bespeaking a brutish and backwoods lifestyle. So sometimes I'll just be like looking at that sentence and I'll turn it into flavor as I'm describing it as right. well. So I like having these handy in addition to Hero Lab because it's just,
you know what?
It's just good to have.
Yeah, you're saying that's the exact same thing I was just saying about my NPCs. Is that having that little bit of flavor to add where you're dropping very extremely specific things about them, it just creates a higher level of immersion for the players.
Yeah. When a creature dies, you're like, can I tell, like, these normally travel in pairs? Are they alone? Where do they have it? I'll be like, roll a knowledge. I'm just looking at the all the flavor text that comes after it. Usually they travel as a mated pair. What'd you roll? 12? You still don't know anything.
Yeah. All right, well, that does it for me. Steven, thank you so much for a really terrific question. We have to get running here, but I want to say, Troy, thank you so much for having me over for the old cannon fodder, and I think that we should make Dell's Summer Shandy Margaritas the
official
standard,
drink, yeah.
The official drink of Cannon Fodder Summer Edition.
I like it. My liver maybe doesn't like it as much.
But we're doing it, buddy.
We're doing it. Hey, you know what? You want to immerse your players in a campaign. Immerse yourself first. And we're going to immerse ourselves in Narragansett's Del Shandy Margaritas.
All right, take it easy, guys.
See you now.